We'll hear arguments first this morning in the state of California against the state of Texas, an original jurisdiction case. Mr. Falk, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I should like to begin by identifying four of the factors which prompted California to invoke this Court's jurisdiction. For these same considerations, in our judgment, make the exercise of that jurisdiction appropriate and indeed imperative. The first jurisdiction, first consideration was the technical basis for jurisdiction under Texas versus Florida, a point which, of course, I'll be elaborating upon throughout this argument, namely that the tax claims which have been asserted by the various taxing entities exceed the available assets of the estate. For the moment, suffice it to say that once we determined that this was a situation in which the tax claims did have that quality, we had a very practical and real concern that if California were successful in its own courts, the judgment it obtained might not be collectible.
Do we know as a fact that the tax claims do exceed the assets in the estate?
Yes, we assert that in our pleading, and I think have demonstrated.
Has that been established at all? Is it agreed to?
I think it is not agreed to, Mr. Yes. Justice Brennan, by Texas, and I am prepared to discuss the reasons why we think that it's demonstrably so that they do. Just as an arithmetical matter, the tax rates total 101% on all of the major portion of the estate.
But do we know the size of the estate? Does anyone know what exactly?
Well, the estate has filed a return, and we've attached to our pleading an appendix, Appendix A, which sets forth the calculations of the taxes under the various federal and state rates based on the return filed by the estate on their own agreed values. The problem becomes exacerbated if the rates if the amount of the estate is greater. But even on those rates, there's a shortfall of many millions of dollars.
This is the federal estate tax return.
The federal estate tax return, and also the California IT-22.
Are the California assets, and you do have real estate in the Los Angeles area.
Not
the
in the
estate does, don't you?
No, the estate does not, Mr. Justice
well,
Blackmun.
Suma Corporation does.
Suma does, but unless it's an alter ego, we can't reach it.
Are those assets sufficient to pay the California death taxes if it's determined that Mr. Hughes was not a California domiciliary?
No, because we can't reach the assets of Suma unless it is proven to be an alter ego of Mr. Hughes.
Well, that's that's in litigation, is it not, in Delaware?
I don't believe it's in litigation in Delaware.
Could it be?
I don't believe it could be in Delaware. I suppose we certainly could contend, and I think would if compelled to, but it's far from clear that such a contention would be accepted.
Has Texas intervened in the Delaware litigation?
Texas has been named as a party in the Delaware litigation and contends, and I must say I think rightly, that it cannot be made a party there for reasons of sovereign immunity, and I think for reasons of due process. It has not voluntarily appeared, as I understand it. They've made a motion to quash, and that motion is pending.
California has made no appearance.
California has made no appearance and intends to make no appearance.
Mr. Falk, don't you suppose there may be some controversy over the values submitted in the federal estate tax return?
I fully expect that there will. I believe that all of the taxing authorities will contend that the values are greater.
For example, Suma Corporation.
Suma Corporation being the main asset. And there is an Internal Revenue Service investigation underway, and the states are doing likewise. I think it's quite unlikely that the values will be less. The values that were reported, to put it mildly, were conservative, we think, and we think the values will be larger. But it would take a dramatic cut, which is, I think, inconceivable for the problem.
Well, I just wonder, on the issue before us, how that bears on whether or not we ought to accept the original jurisdiction.
I think that there is really no realistic possibility. Texas doesn't contend that the values are less. And there is really no realistic possibility that the values would be such that lower rates of tax would apply. So we are in a situation in which I think it is safe to say that the tax rates combine to 101%. And that problem is exacerbated by a couple of factors that are mentioned in our brief. One, that some of the items which are expenditures by the estate, for example, for litigation expenses, which are awful here, are not deductible under California law. As a result, although they're losing the money in the form of these expenses, it doesn't reduce their California taxes. And it, again, that only exacerbates the shortfall. The second problem is that SUMA has encountered really staggering losses in the years since Mr. Hughes died. It was $29 million of operating losses in 1976, and I think the figure was $169 million, if I recall correctly, of reduction of net book values in that same year. 77 isn't formalized. We've been advised informally that the figure will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 million.
Is there any controversy over whether all of the marshals, all of the assets of Mr. Hughes have been marshaled?
I'm not aware of any. I think they have pretty much been identified in our the subject of administrations in several states.
In your view,
the amount of money, is that book value or just actual money?
Well, the estate tax return was based on an appraisal of the value, not on book value, and that will be the basis on which tax will be concerned. There's a pending controversy as to whether that appraisal is an appropriate one.
For purposes of our evaluating whether this is or is not an appropriate case for original jurisdiction, in your view, would it make any difference whether the total of all the taxes would consume 95% of the entire assets or whether they would be 105%?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, in my view, it would not, but I think under Texas versus Florida, the 100% mark has special significance. I don't think I have to persuade you of my alternative view, but I might, in response to your question, suggest you briefly what it is. It starts with Massachusetts versus Missouri, 308 U.S., where the court refused to entertain a suit to prevent Missouri from imposing a tax on a trust that had been established by a Massachusetts domiciliary with a Missouri trustee or trustees. The court distinguished Texas versus Florida in that case, but on grounds which to me suggest that the 100% figure is not the beginning, is not the end of the case. After noting that the trust assets of the Missouri Trust were sufficient to pay the taxes of both states, the court went on to say, and I'm going to quote from it, it was not shown that the tax claims of the two states are mutually exclusive, and that, to the contrary, again quoting, the validity of each claim is wholly independent of that of the other. In other words, it wasn't a central issue, domicile. From this, we think that there is jurisdiction in a suit between states in this area where two things are shown. First, that two or more states each seek to levy a tax on a mutually exclusive ground, as there was in Texas versus Florida and as there is here, domicile. And secondly, that the claim of the defendant state in some concrete way, in some real way, injures the plaintiff state. Now, in Texas versus Florida, that second element of concrete injury was shown by the fact that the tax claims exceeded 100%. And so you had a classic in the nature of interpleader situation. Even if that were not here, we believe that our pleadings show another kind of concrete injury that satisfies the standing and case or controversy requirements. And that is this. We found ourselves with an inheritance tax claim which we and the estate mutually desired to compromise and to thereby avoid years of costly litigation. The pendency of the Texas claim was all that stood in the way of California and the estate totally resolving the inheritance tax matter. It was the pendency of that claim which prevented the estate from unconditionally agreeing to settle this case for a very understandable reason. If they agreed to pay a large tax to California and then were liable to Texas for a 16% tax, the result would be devastating. If they were unwilling, and understandably so, to agree. This is the problem with any situation of an interpleader type where you can't get all of the parties into one court.
But that really is never a basis for classic interpleader, is it?
No, it's not. I don't contend that it's an interpleader. I say that it is, if you were forced to conclude that there were not 100%, that the taxes didn't exceed 100%, there would still be a controversy between California and Texas, not in the classic interpleader mold, but simply because Texas is asserting an inconsistent claim with inconsistent with California, that would prevent California from resolving a major controversy with the estate.
Well, now, you say Texas is asserting an inconsistent claim, and then you say that because of the assertion of that claim, California is unable to settle with the estate. Those are two separate assertions you make, and both of them would have to be upheld in order to support your alternative theory.
You mean factually upheld?
Survive the pleading stage.
Yes, yes. Now, I do want to stress that this is not our primary submission. It arises and is necessary only if we're mistaken and the tax claims do not exceed 100%. I'm absolutely satisfied that they do, but I, in response to the Chief Justice's question, I wanted to develop that point.
Well, what sort of a cause of action would that be? Well, let me begin by asking you this. What if Texas asserted that the decedent had been a domiciliary of Texas at the time of his death and asserted a tax claim successfully based upon that fact, that jurisdictional fact, against all his intangible property that amounted to, say, 40%. And let's say that California asserted in appropriate litigation that the decedent had been a domiciliary of California at the time of his death, and based upon that jurisdictional finding, asserted a tax claim that amounted to another 40% of the decedent estate. What possible federal question would be involved?
I don't think there is a federal question.
And no lawsuit between those two states.
I do disagree with the
no
second
controversy
statement.
Between those two states.
Well, the controversy that I perceive in that situation is not a federal question, but it is a controversy. Both states can't be right, although...
Certainly they can be.
No, I think both states can successfully get judgments, but as a conceptual matter, one cannot have two domiciles. That was the point of Texas versus Florida, that only one of the four states could be
correct. The point of the Dorrance case was just the point implied in my question.
I think the point, Mr. Justice Stewart, of the previous cases, including the Dorrance litigation, is that although one can have but one domicile, our federal system
Texas
permits...
Texas is entitled to determine that he was domiciled in Texas. California is entitled to determine he was domiciled in California.
I agree. And
those two inconsistent determinations create no federal question of
any
kind.
I agree. They do not. And that, of course, is why Texas versus Florida arises, because there is no solution to the problem where the taxes exceed 100% save for an action in this court. There is no other way to get a unitary adjudication.
And then what law does this court apply in such a case as that?
Well, I think in Texas versus Florida, and I think it would be true here, that the court will have no choice of law problem because there is no difference in the law of the two states.
What if there were?
I do not know from any decision of this court. I assume it would have to apply its own principles of domicile.
What if Texas had one set of criteria for determining domicile and California had quite a different set?
If that were the law, Mr. Justice Stewart, one aspect of Texas versus Florida would not be present, and that was emphasized in the court's opinion there, that the law was the same in all four states.
Well, what difference? Why is that significant?
Well, as I understand an interpleader, the interpleader concept, or in the nature of interpleader concept, it is that you have inconsistent claims, and if the laws of the two states were substantially different, so that it would be possible under the laws of both states for both states to be right, I'm not sure in my own mind that the court would then appropriately exercise jurisdiction.
Well, what law should the court apply?
Well, if it were to entertain jurisdiction, it would have no basis for choosing between the two, other than to pick the law that made the most sense.
Why, as a matter of, we'd be free to do that, would we?
I think you are, as part of your original jurisdiction. But I want to stress that I don't believe Texas contends that that's the case here. The law of the two states, really the law of the nation.
What is it, some sort of federal, not federal common law, because this is an equitable action, federal equity?
Well, I think it's the law of the states here, of all 50 states, I believe, that define domicile in the same way.
Mr. Falk, following through on Justice Stewart's question, it's always been assumed that inheritance taxes follow domicile. Do you think in our jurisprudence we've gone beyond that point or are about to, and that maybe individual states can rest on something other than common law notions of domicile?
I think that there would be no due process objection to other bases for taxation, and I think there are cases that support that statement. However, the laws of Texas and California that have been invoked by our respective states do not assert taxes on any other basis. The basis for taxation in Texas and the basis for taxation in California that brings us here is domicile. So I don't think you have to reach that question. That's not what we're attempting to do.
Mr. Falk, aren't there cases and decisions in these original jurisdiction cases where this court has fashioned a rule of law?
Yes, I think there have been many.
When we do that, what are we doing?
I think you're fashioning a federal rule. I assume that the...
Well, then what's unique about our doing that in this situation?
Only that I don't have to, because there's no conflict between the laws of the two states.
Why do you suppose in Mr. Justice Stone's opinion for the court in Texas against Florida, he emphasized the fact that the laws of the four states there involved were... basically identical with respect to domicile. Was that of any importance at all?
I think it demonstrates that it's an appropriate in the nature of interpleader action, because the claims are identical. You have two claims; they can't both be right as an independent matter, and therefore it's an appropriate.
You don't think it might also be right as making it easy to fashion that rule as the federal rule applicable?
I do think that if you were confronted with a situation in which the laws of the states were different and
well,
in conflict,
but I say
then
the
you
emphasis,
would have to.
But maybe Mr. Justice Stone's emphasis on the fact that all four were the same just made it easier to
I think that's the answer. I think the Escheat cases following Western Union versus Pennsylvania are a perfect example of a case in which the court made a decision which has to be federal. In its origin, as to which rule of Escheat would govern the resolution of those several state conflicts.
And dividing interstate river waters.
I think that's the same.
Do you contend here that there is a federal constitutional principle which says that a state may impose an inheritance tax or an estate tax only on one particular set of criteria?
I have not contended that, and I don't think it's necessary to do so, because the laws of the two states base their tax on that ground. We're not challenging the basis for the Texas tax other than its factual basis. I mentioned Western Union.
May I question the proposition? I'm intrigued by my brother Stewart's question. You say the law of the two states is identical. Now, maybe the black letter law is the same, but we all know that there are all sorts of gradations when you apply a rule. Maybe in Texas they attach greater weight to the place of birth in determining what the ultimate conclusion is. In California they may attach greater weight to some other fact. There are shadings which may produce inconsistent results, which one could describe as differences in the laws of the two jurisdictions, could they?
I think that is not so. I'm no expert on Texas law, but I have followed their domicile trial here, and of course I've read Texas versus Florida. That case was initiated by Texas, and it found its law to be the same as the other three states, and I read the papers there, and I understood it to be the Texas law then, and I think now, was in agreement really with the common law of the 50 states of the Union on domicile. I'm really aware of no difference.
The law of the two states is really completely identical. Can't we be confident that the two states will reach the same result on the same set of facts?
I am confident that they, well, at least we know this. We know that a jury in Texas has rendered a verdict that is inconsistent with the position California asserts. Now, we're here.
California asserts as a litigant.
I recognize. I can't tell you what the California courts will do any more than Texas could in Texas versus Florida. That litigation, of course, came here before any litigation had occurred in any state. The court rejected Justice Frankfurter's suggestion that it was premature. I had mentioned the first of the considerations, and the second one has to do with Western Union, and I think Western Union is an important case here. In our view, for reasons set forth in our papers in some detail, we think Western Union took Texas versus Florida one more step and made the exercise of this court's jurisdiction mandatory and not simply optional in cases where, and they're rare, where two or more states seek to tax the estate beyond the point of confiscation. I have read and reread Texas's reply on that point, and I don't understand it. They seem to contend that Western Union is distinguishable because it involved a dispute over property, the location of which was in question, whereas here and in Texas versus Florida, the property is located within the borders of Texas, and thus it has exclusive in rem jurisdiction over it. The property, for the most part, that is in this estate consists of stock in a corporation, which will be taxed in the place of domicile. And so Texas's position assumes the answer to the question that has to be litigated. That really is the same problem as there was in Western Union. And the court said in that case that Pennsylvania lacked jurisdiction, as a matter of federal constitutional law, lacked jurisdiction to proceed because it could not assure Western Union that it would not be liable inconsistently to the escheat demands of other states. And I think that one passage in the court's opinion on that point is quite significant. The court said, the situation here in Western Union is in all material respects like that which caused us to take jurisdiction in Texas versus Florida. So as we read Western Union and as we read it today, that decision obliged us, and indeed obliged Texas, to come to this court rather than to proceed in our own state courts once it became clear that tax claims were being asserted in excess of the amount of the estate. Finally, another factor that I want to mention just briefly that brought us here, and I think is important for this court's exercise of jurisdiction, was our own sense of fairness. To have proceeded independently to litigate the tax claim in our own courts, as Texas sought to do, even if we could do so, Western Union notwithstanding, simply did not comport with our notion of a fair and appropriate process. It seemed to us that it would be incredibly inefficient to generate multiplicitous litigation, which would only degenerate into a three-ring circus. Without a ringmaster, there would be litigation in California, Texas, Nevada, Delaware, all proceeding without any ability to achieve.
Are you familiar with Lord Canning's statement, save, oh, save me from the candid friend?
Well, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I don't pretend to have been looking out for the welfare of the heirs. We were here and acted, of course, in interest of the taxpayers of California. But it does seem to us that it is appropriate for governmental officials, taxing officials, to be concerned with the fairness of their conduct. After all, we're accountable to that set of standards as well. And it seemed to us that all of the decisions that are relevant in this court and all of the literature of the last 40 years since Texas versus Florida condemned a process by which an estate can be wiped out by inconsistent domicile litigation in several states. That strikes me as unfair. I think it ought to strike the court as unfair. I think it would strike the public as unfair. And we chose not to do it for all of the reasons that I've suggested, and I don't mean to be sanctimonious about it. I think it was an appropriate factor for us to consider.
To address the argument of Texas and of the impact, if any, of the agreement you've made, the states made?
Yes, I am. The position of Texas, as I understand it, is that our agreement demonstrates in some fashion that we are here suing on behalf of private citizens and not on behalf of a state, and that makes relevant the small number of cases, New Hampshire versus Louisiana, Oklahoma, X. Rel. Johnson versus Cook, which disentitle a state to do so, really on the ground of the 11th Amendment and as a limitation on the court's jurisdiction. That position of Texas is both factually and legally unsound here. There are two cases on that point that I want to call to the court's attention. One is cited in our reply brief, South Dakota versus North Carolina, where the court distinguished those earlier cases in a situation in which a small number of bonds of a state had been assigned to South Dakota, and they had been assigned unconditionally. The motive of the donor was perfectly apparent from writings that are cited in the court's opinion. He brought that suit for reasons of his, or he made that donation for reasons of his own. The court said motive of the donor is irrelevant. South Dakota is suing for interests, however small, of its own, and the action can be maintained. Another case not cited in our brief, but that I do want to call to the court's attention, is North Dakota versus Minnesota in 263 U.S. at 365, and then another opinion at 584. There a suit was brought by one state complaining of flooding caused by the acts of a neighboring state. The loss caused by the flooding did millions of dollars of damage to private lands in the plaintiff state and something like $5,000 of damages to the state's own bridges and highways, as I recall. The court allowed the action, even though the interest of the state was rather small. And even though it noted in the second of the two opinions that the landowners of the plaintiff state who had been affected by the flooding, and I quote, raised a fund to conduct the litigation. So I think it's apparent that in that case the state was induced to act by the private citizens who stood to benefit. Thus, as I read the cases, a state may sue in this court, notwithstanding that private citizens are benefited, and even though private citizens induced the lawsuit. Now, having said all that, I want to say that that's not what happened here. The record before this court, and I refer to an affidavit that I have filed at the time of the application for a preliminary injunction, shows that the decision to file this suit was made several weeks before we had any conversation whatever with the estate on the subject of settlement. And in fact, General Hill, I'm sure, will acknowledge, I personally told him in a meeting I had with him in Austin, Texas, on October 21, 3 weeks before the settlement, and before we had any conversation with the estate whatsoever, that we had intended to initiate suit in this court, that we were drafting papers and so forth. So I think that the suggestion that we are here carrying the bag for the estate, acting for its benefit, is just plainly false as a factual matter. I have just a few moments left, and I'd like to save that time for rebuttal if the court has no further questions of me at this time.
Very well, Mr. Falk. Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Let me first quickly address a few questions that were raised by the court before I get into my prepared remarks. First, it is not agreed that the taxes will exceed the estate, the combined taxes. There has been no agreement as to the value of the estate. There has been one appraisal by Merrill Lynch, which is highly in dispute, we think is ridiculously low. California can collect, if it pierces the corporate veil, and that's been done every time it's been tried, whether in the TWA litigation or the RKO litigation, that Mr. Hughes, that you can pierce the summa veil. And if they do that, they can get out $112 million in land right by the airport and on running along the beach, highly valuable, even if they don't establish domicile.
That is California land.
That's the tax stat. Yes, sir. The status rule California would allow them, regardless of domicile.
Right.
And there is a controversy as to whether every asset has been marshaled. Our comptroller, state comptroller, is working on that diligently now. And Summa's inability to make money and prosper is, we think, highly exaggerated and certainly not the kind of speculation that this court can indulge in to determine whether there's actually going to be more taxes than the estate can stand. And then finally, Texas versus Illinois does require, clearly, that our inconsistent claim be such that it would impair California's right to collect on its own claim, if it has a meritorious claim. And that case obviously does not require or contemplate that our inconsistent claim be such that it would simply impair California's ability to get this estate to settle with them on some basis that they would consider favorable. That's not a right that this court's jurisdiction is available to protect. And they said Texas was all that was in their way. All that was in their way to get a settlement is what he forgot to add. And not in their way to try their case, not in their way to assert their claim or the merits of their claim, not in a way to impair their ability to collect on taxes, but in their way to get a favorable settlement of a claim that they are very reluctant to try on its merits. That's what Texas is in the way of. And Justice Stevens' question is correct in suggesting that we should be confident that the courts in both states would reach the same results on the same facts. And certainly out of respect for the state courts and their proceeding, we should at least not indulge in the opposite presumption in order to try to sustain original jurisdiction here. He speaks of our own sense of fairness being the only thing that brought us here. Then why did they wait 19 months after we began our litigation to suddenly emerge into an atmosphere of sweetness and light and fairness? And why didn't they try then, early, to come here? And why, when they come, don't they come on the strength of their own claim, if fairness is their standard? Why do they come here tendering the limited issue and the only issue to this court, and that is Texas domicile? Now, it's Texas' position that the agreement that was entered into on November the 10th, 1977, the day before this motion for leave was filed, entered into between the estate's administrators, certain Hughes heirs, and California, amounts really to the estate and the heirs agreeing to pay California in money and services to bring this case, and that therefore this court is prohibited both by the letter and the spirit of the United States Constitution from entertaining any suit arising in your original jurisdiction concept under these kind of circumstances. We say your holding here must be that in no case involving and invoking or undertaking to invoke your original jurisdiction based on Article 3, Section 2, and 28 U.S.C., Section 1251A1, suits between states, in no case will that jurisdiction be extended where an agreement has been executed prior thereto, providing that the petitioning state is granted the right to recover state death taxes regardless of the merits of its own case. And where the petitioning state...
May I understand this, Mr. Attorney General? Is this an argument that, in fact, California's fronting for the heirs...
No question that's what's happening.
Is that what it is? Well, I thought this agreement guarantees California the sum of $2 million, doesn't it?
2%, even if Texas wins.
That's what it is. A 2% or not
a flat sum? We're not afraid to litigate the matter before.
So I gather your argument is we ought not take this case in original jurisdiction because if California is merely fronting for the heirs, that creates the kind of 11th Amendment problem
Absolutely.
That Mr. Falk referred to.
Absolutely. You see, they can recover pursuant to this agreement solely if the court takes jurisdiction and takes action, regardless of the quality of their claim. It's a barter for the jurisdiction of this court, pure and simple. In short, we think...
And is it that the heirs come out better, at least inheritance tax-wise, under this California agreement, than perhaps they're going to come out if Texas can collect?
You see, Annette Loomis is the co-administrator with Will Loomis in the administration in Texas.
I'm sorry, I don't know these
Annette heirs. Loomis is his mother.
Who?
Annette Loomis is Will Loomis's mother. And under Nevada law and California law, in case of intestacy, she would be the sole heir. Under Texas law, if Texas is the domicile state, it opens up the possibility of heirship to some 400 people that have filed in that court. In short, the rule must be, we believe, that if a state comes here under Article 3, Section 2, it must come clearly and unequivocally under its own statute or law on which its claim is based and unfettered by an agreement to come here for a benefit to be bestowed regardless of the merits of the underlying claim.
Mr. Attorney General, if the agreement had not been made, do you think the state of Nevada would be in here?
They're not a taxing state.
I know, but would they be in here?
Well, I don't think so. I have no reason to believe that the Attorney General of Nevada would have entered into this agreement. Have no interest at all, have shown no interest, any more than California did until the eve of our trial. That's when they got this agreement and started showing an interest. If they were really interested, why didn't they come here? Why did they permit us to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, put in thousands of man-hours, out in the wide open, most of it and a lot of it carried out in California, with California counsel assisting us, travel all over the world, and take 50-odd depositions, and discover hundreds of thousands of documents out of 3 or 4 million documents that we were actually both sides working with pretrial. Case set for trial. January of 1977, it was set for trial in September of 1977, all of which they knew about. And let us go ahead and proceed and go to all that trouble and work in our own court and have a fair and square trial with overwhelming evidence. And I can't obviously retry it here, but it's a case that'll be won wherever it's heard. And then come here and ask on behalf of the estate, really, you relitigate the Texas domicile issue. And that's all we're going to tender to you, that very limited issue.
Well, is that, as you see it, is what the issue would be if this complaint is filed, whether or not the decedent lived in Texas? Is that going to be the question, or is the question going to be where did he live?
That's all they tender. They won't tender anything else. Their motion tenders only to this court the question of Texas domicile. You see, they just simply want this court to take it, give it to a master, hope that they can gang up on us and get the master to find.
Well, what will the issue be before the master?
Texas domicile, whether Texas was not the domicile.
Whether
state.
Or not Texas was the domicile of the decedent at the time of his death.
That's all.
Not where was the domicile of the decedent at the time of
they
his death.
They win when you cut us up.
Mm-hmm. Quite different, therefore, from Texas and Florida.
Oh, you can't touch it with radar to try to pick up Texas versus Illinois in this case. It's using this court undertaking to, for an inequitable and unjust purpose that clearly violates the provisions of the 11th Amendment as a suit which in reality is for the benefit of private litigants, and would also bring this court's equitable jurisdiction into play without due regard to, first, the necessity of the court's participation. It would invoke it without due concern for the possible abuse of the court's jurisdiction in other cases, without first requiring California to utilize its own courts to determine the underlying merits of its claim, without due regard for the fact that Texas has already obtained a domicile verdict in its own court.
That's the point. If a master appointed, he couldn't ignore that Texas proceeding, could he? He would have to go into it, wouldn't he?
Well, we'd certainly claim that he couldn't, but I'll tell you, the jurisdiction once taken here, mm-hmm. and a master's report is so awesome that I find that in some cases it just seems to wipe out a lot of things that have happened before. It's one thing to say we just want a little jurisdiction for a little purpose, but once you appoint that master...
Well, what could the master do to that?
He could conceivably find that Texas was not the domicile state.
Then we'd have a real conflict, wouldn't we?
You'd have a honey of a situation.
And that's a matter of fact, if perhaps, or in any event, if it's a matter at all of law, it's a matter of state law, isn't it?
Clearly. And they're asking you to come in here without regard to requiring California to really come and present a hard and concrete case
of
possible harm.
Yes, sir. There is a federal statute on the books, apropos of my brother Marshall's question, that says federal courts must give full faith and credit to the decrees of state courts. Do you think that binds this court as a federal court in a case under its original jurisdiction?
We'll certainly take that position, but I don't...
Do you have any reason to take it other than that you think it helps your case?
Well, you don't need to.
I'll settle for that reason until another...
General Hill, you don't need...
Yeah.
You don't need to take a position the way the case is lined up here, do you?
Really not, because we just have considerations here that haven't been thought out. You don't even get into alternate forums. And this court, and I know I need not unduly cite your own opinions, but this is so relevant to what I'm trying to convey from Texas standpoint, is your statement recently made in Arizona versus New Mexico. And may I please quote it? We recently reaffirmed that our original jurisdiction should be invoked sparingly in Illinois versus City of Milwaukee, where we additionally stated, we construe 28 U.S.C. Section 1251A1, as we do Article 3, Section 2, to honor our original jurisdiction, but to make it obligatory only in appropriate cases. And the question of what is appropriate concerns, of course, the seriousness and dignity of the claim. Yet beyond that, it necessarily involves the availability of another forum where there is jurisdiction over the named parties, where the issues tendered may be litigated, and where appropriately relief may be had. We incline to sparing use of our original jurisdiction so that our increasing duties with the appellate docket will not suffer. And nearly 40 years ago in Massachusetts versus Missouri, to which Counsel Falk alluded, this court said, in the exercise of our original jurisdiction, so as to truly fulfill the constitutional purpose, we not only must look to the nature of the interest of the complaining state, the essential quality of the right asserted, but we must also inquire whether recourse to that jurisdiction is necessary for the state's protection. Now then, with that in mind, the narrowness of the issue tendered by California, that is, a negative finding against Texas, is proof enough that the quality of the interest attempted to be provided to California, that is, an 18% interest by settlement that she may not be entitled to under any merits, is not of the kind to be entertained here by this court in invoking that solemn jurisdiction. If California really wants to litigate its entitlement, that issue of domicile can and should be, under the circumstances here presented, litigated in California. If California is successful there on that issue, it can repetition here if, in fact, facts and information show that there's more tax, that they can't get their taxation, and then you could decide whether to take the case or let it be heard in the Delaware Forum where the question of the Summa Corporation exist and where any problems that do in fact ever occur, not pursuant to some settlement agreement, but pursuant to honest claims being presented.
Well, Mr. Attorney General, you aren't, are you willing to litigate in Delaware?
When we get to the position.
Well, the answer is no right now.
No, no, not now. We clearly are not. Well, need not, and need not anticipate it. If California does try.
Of course, it might be a form that if both of you agreed could solve the entire matter.
The problem. That's true.
Would the Delaware Forum, as you call it, have jurisdiction over a lawsuit between the state of Texas and the state of California?
It could only come up, and I don't want to be bound by this, because I don't think it's necessary for us to get into it in this proceeding, but as I see it, the only way that it could possibly, underscore possibly, come up would be if California, in fact, secured a favorable finding in its court on the merits, and then the proof showed that it was impossible for us to get the matter disposed of, or that harm of 120% and these sort of figures that I think are ridiculous and never will come to pass. At most, I think you're looking at 101. If that, with a going concern, able to pay it out over 10 years. But in any event, if all of those speculated problems finally came to rest, then you would have the one piece of intangible property to which all would be looking. And that's the Summa stock, which is just, as you know, there's only one stockholder. There's 75,000 shares of stock, but only one stockholder. It's presently being held and voted by Mr. Will Newman under their order. I think they would have that would then be a forum where you could determine, all right, as between us, how do we tax the intangible.
And that forum would have jurisdiction, would it?
I think.
Because this is my question, over a lawsuit between the sovereign state of Texas and the sovereign state of California.
If we come in there and assert that we want to get at the intangible stock asset, which is Situs in Delaware, that being the corporate basis, then.
Well, whatever the lawsuit was about, I'm talking about any kind of a lawsuit between those two parties. And I'm talking about jurisdiction.
I think what I'm saying, Mr. Justice Stewart, is that would be an election, I think, for these states to make.
But it'd have to be voluntary.
I think so.
Neither could compel the other to appear in a Delaware court. Could it?
No.
I suppose it would be in a matter of two or more states filing competing claims to the same competence. Yes.
Right. And then let me just close by...
To a Delaware asset that is clearly within the jurisdiction of the Delaware court.
Well, I think all these questions about Delaware, if I might say, so that I don't go further here than is obviously necessary to decide what we're here about, is simply to say that question can be addressed if it ever becomes proper to be addressed, and this court will have an opportunity to look at that if that ever becomes germane.
General Hill, a little while ago, you said that California should go about its business and proceed in its own courts and so forth, and then come here when certain things are established. Would you be opposing original jurisdiction at that time also?
I don't know. It would just depend on if they have a case that's at that time stated without reference to agreement under Texas versus Illinois, and I thought Texas versus Illinois applied, I'd then have to make a determination as to whether to ask you to deal with it. But you don't have to deal with it here. I might want to ask you to deal with it if it ever came to that. I think it's something this court might want to reconsider.
General Hill, at least the agreement accomplished the elimination of Nevada as a possible party. This is one thing it accomplished. After all, you are in a position here of representing a state which itself brought the Texas against Florida litigation. And now you're representing a state which denies the original jurisdiction of this court. You're hung with it, but there it is.
Well, I'm not. General McGraw, 45 years ago, came into this court with a lot of other attorney generals, pretty much by agreement. Once the court wouldn't let them in until they could go out and resolve the fact of what the taxes were going to be so that the master wouldn't have all that foolish work to do. And then when they came back in, and practically an agreed situation, the court took it. Justice Frankfurter didn't think much of it, but that's neither here nor there. They did take it, and they heard it, and they resolved it. And Texas, who brought it, lost. I think that General McGraw, were he here today, would be applauding what I'm doing and believe that it's totally consistent with what I should be doing, and it's an entirely different situation. This is not in any sense a Texas versus Florida case, and
well,
that's
General
the full
Hill,
answer
it,
to it.
I take it at a later time your first claim would be that the matter of domicile would not be open for any kind of reconsideration, because
that
it's been determined in the Texas
clearly
court.
Clearly would be. I'd certainly be derelict.
And that would be true later if you all thought that you should go to Delaware to try to...
Exactly.
You would say that...
Full faith and credit.
Everything might be opening, but not down domicile.
Those are
exactly... It wouldn't even be reviewable by this court, is it, or any other federal court. It's not a question of federal law, is it?
And so I just conclude by reminding that if there's the slightest doubt about why we're here, and that I say we're here out of the estate's worry over the Texas domicile finding, not only for estate tax purposes but for other purposes, that it ought to be perfectly clear when you look at this agreement that that's why we're here, because in addition to giving them the 2% guarantee, they come back and say, we'll give you all of the lawyers you need. Some of them are here today in court. We'll work with you hand in glove, and we'll give you all of our depositions. We'll give you all of our work product, and maybe together we can do Texas in.
Mr. Attorney General, a while ago you said that the figure of 120%, that is, referring to the aggregate amount of taxes, was absurd, ridiculous, something like that, and that in any event it wasn't more than 101%. Now, for the purposes of this case, what's the difference whether it's 100, the taxes are 101% of all the assets, or 190% of all the assets?
Well, I think for today, at least, for the purpose of this hearing, the answer would be that if it's 101, and we don't know, but let's just assume for the purpose of your question it is, then California is petitioning here to get you to vitalize an agreement which would cut their would harm them 68% of what they say they're entitled to under their figures, and yet they want you to do it under the authority of a case that would say we're going to protect you from 1% of harm. So under this agreement, it's just simply immaterial inquiry. Now, as to whether it's 101%, ends up being 98%, it's not the inquiry, the basic inquiry before this court, because the fundamental vice in their case is this agreement. You can't get away from it. Will Loomis, and it's in our brief, used the words, I have them written down somewhere, where he said, in effect, that we're here pursuant to this agreement. That's his sworn testimony given in December. Now, there cannot be any doubt about that. We're here pursuant to that agreement. And that is the full answer, a complete answer, a total answer to the denial of this motion for leave to file and invoke this court's original jurisdiction. Never should this court tolerate that kind of a situation. And you'd rue the day if you did and open the gates for this kind of trading around between high state tax cases, states with weak claims to try to get negative findings against 16% states with good claims.
General Hill, what is the present status of the Texas litigation?
We have obtained a jury verdict, and we'll have a judgment entered on April the 4th.
I suppose there are motions to set the verdict aside pending, are they?
There's a motion for judgment which we have filed. I'll have to ask my associate whether they have filed. I have not seen the pleadings recently. I would not want to misstate. If they have filed a motion to set it aside, I would be most surprised.
The judgment.
They argued the case about 30 minutes, although they had several hours to argue, because when all the evidence was in, they didn't have much to talk about. And there's plenty of evidence to support the verdict. The case is cleanly tried. It's going to stand up without any question.
But they're whatever the accuracy of your prediction, there will be an opportunity of an appeal. Will there
absolutely
not, in the state court system?
Go through our appellate process, right, which is, I'm sure, under circumstances like we're faced with, that's something we can contemplate. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Mr. Falk, do you have anything further?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, let me say that there's no doubt I agree with some of the implication of some of the questions. There is no other forum. If California and Texas each secure a judgment and we find ourselves in that situation that General Hill contemplates, there is no possibility, absent consent of both states, of litigating that in the Delaware courts. They have no jurisdiction to decide controversies between states. Only this court does. And as to everybody else, those two state judgments are entitled to full faith and credit, as Texas versus Florida and the previous cases make clear.
Mr. Falk, if your complaint is filed and an answer is filed and the matter is referred to a master, what will the issue be, issue or issues?
Justice Stewart, I suppose the court could go beyond the pleadings and resolve the question of where he was domiciled. It is true that the pleading only asks the court to determine whether or not the Texas claim is a valid one. And the reason for that is, as someone on the court commented a moment ago, that we have settled with the estate the controversy vis-a-vis Nevada, the Bahamas, Mexico,
so there
and
won't
the world.
Be very, so Nevada certainly is not now and presumably will not be a party.
That's correct.
And yet, as I understand the facts from reading these papers and from reading the newspapers, the decedent spent, insofar as he lived in the United States of America, resided, was physically in the United States of America, and is the last years of his life, most of those years were in Nevada, weren't they?
No, he spent about 38 of years in California.
No, I'm talking about
the last 3 or 4
the
years.
The final years of his life,
were
insofar
in
as he was in the United States, he was in Nevada most of the time.
Suffice it to say that the parties recognized a very complex controversy, a close question
well,
on that issue.
If there is generally, in an adversarial system of justice, you have parties litigating, and the theory is from that litigation emerges the truth. But if Nevada's not even going to be in this lawsuit, how can a very accurate assessment of the facts be made?
I don't think the court has to adjudicate this, to finally resolve.
Generally, a lawsuit isn't destined to determine a negative, that somebody did not live in a certain state.
But the problem here was that we were facing a very complex litigation with many alternatives. We undertook to settle that litigation. We could have settled all of it, but Texas wasn't a party to it and didn't choose to be. We settled all that we could, and we have this remaining part of the problem that has to be adjudicated.
Don't you think that to answer the question you put in your prayer, aren't you going to have to decide where he was domiciled?
I think we're going to put on evidence that will make it possible for the master to make that.
How can you say he isn't? Aren't you going to have to conclude that he was domiciled somewhere else
and therefore he was domiciled
in Texas?
Well, I think we're going to show that he was domiciled in California for at least you know, 30 or 40 years of his life. Whether we go, whether it is necessary to go on and disprove the contention that in 1966, when he moved to Las Vegas, he then changed his domicile to Nevada, I don't know that we have to do that. Once we have disproved the Texas domicile, I think we will have done enough, but we will be prepared to do the other as well.
Do you think it's sufficient to show that he was domiciled in California up till 1966 and then left California and never returned and spent the rest of his life in Nevada?
It wouldn't be sufficient but for the fact that the estate has agreed to pay us a tax if we can make that showing.
Mr. Falk, the truth of the matter is that Nevada and the Bahamas, everybody else came in, and California wouldn't come in, but she had a perfect right not to come in. And that's why he filed this lawsuit.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your question, Mr. Justice.
You said a minute ago before my brother White asked your question that Nevada, Bahamas, and everybody else came into California and joined in this agreement, but Texas did not.
Well, not as taxing authorities. The estate agreed to pay us a tax. And in effect, to abandon its defense.
The state of California.
To the state of California.
Unfortunately, it wasn't to you personally.
I'm sorry that it wasn't, Mr. Justice Stewart. To pay California a tax if we can establish that that they are not also liable to Texas. And in so doing, abandon the defense that they otherwise had available, that he was a Bahamian or a Mexican or a citizen of the world or a citizen of Nevada, the domiciliary, I should say.
Texas to do the same thing?
We in fact, did. That's why I went to Texas.
And Texas said no.
Texas said no.
Which they had a right to.
Certainly did.
And so then you filed this lawsuit.
That's correct.
So Texas is right that the reason for this lawsuit is to favor for them to join this agreement.
No, they're not right, Mr. Justice. We decided to bring this lawsuit, had the papers prepared, before this settlement was even discussed.
What's your lawsuit in California? I mean, if Texas had come in, of course you
well,
would.
Well, then we would have had a settlement.
If the theory, Mr. Falk, is that a neutral forum is the only place for a controversy of this kind to be settled, why should not your prayer have been to determine what you say now is the de facto issue? Where was the domicile of Mr. Hughes at the time of his death, instead of just attacking it on in terms of Texas?
Mr. Chief Justice, if jurisdiction turns on that question, we're quite prepared to amend our pleading to ask the court to do just that. And we were originally planning on doing just that. Papers were drafted that asked the court to do that. Papers had even been sent to the printer asking the court to do that without discussion of a settlement because none had been discussed. And we then entered into negotiations with the estate and narrowed the issue. That's what happened. And I fail to see how that can alter the need to have a unitary adjudication. No, this is the only place to go for that adjudication.
If a master were appointed to determine this, and he were to determine that the domicile was Nevada at the time of Mr. Hughes' death, do I understand there's no inheritance tax in Nevada?
That's correct, Mr. Justice.
What then would be the effect of of that determination that he was domiciled in Nevada upon the state's claims to inheritance taxes?
But for the settlement, we would be entitled to collect no domicile-based tax.
But under the agreement, California would still have at least $2 million, is it?
No, under the agreement, if Nevada were found to be the domicile, the estate has, in effect, settled that controversy with us and has agreed to pay us an 18% tax, notwithstanding that. So
California won't lose if the master were to conclude that Nevada was the domicile.
We compromised. Our rate is 24%.
No, but I'm right. Am I
yes,
not?
You are right. And
California would not, but Texas would.
Texas, if they found Nevada, Texas would, of course, not recover either. Yeah. And that reflects a compromise from 24% to 18%.
The only one who would lose would be the United States because then the credit against the federal state tax would apply.
That is true.
Without the agreement, there would be no credit for state taxes paid.
That is true. That is always true in a domicile controversy involving Nevada and the other. Certainly, we are here with a very complex.
It is true with respect to Nevada domiciliaries.
If they are found to be Nevada.
Well, if Nevada was determined to be the domicile, and the estate nevertheless paid you $16 million.
or what is it, 18%? 18%. 18%, which is how many million dollars?
Well, we don't know the value of the estate. It's a substantial
Would the payment from the estate of that 18% be an estate taxes paid deduction?
I'm not really qualified to say. I suppose the IRS has the final say on that. I think the answer is yes. The estate and we have agreed to resolve that part of the controversy, and we have compromised our tax law.
Well, yes, but then one party of the controversy files a lawsuit as part of which it's essential to determine domicile.
Well,
it's determined contrary to the claims of the party filing the suit.
Well, I think that kind of situation can happen in settlements. For example, if you settle a lawsuit with several parties involved and some settle out, that settlement is valid even though other parties do not settle. The litigation proceeds and there is an adverse determination.
Well, wouldn't the estate, Mr. Falk, be in the same position as the executives of the Dorrance estate, where they volunteered the payment to Pennsylvania? And then New Jersey interposed the claim and established domicile and collected $18 million against Pennsylvania $16 million. And then when the executives tried to get back the $16 million from Pennsylvania, they were told, no, that was a voluntary
payment.
I think
they would have no remedy.
Wouldn't that be the same
thing? I think
that's
correct. And I think they would have no remedy. And they would be in that position because they made a decision to opt for a lower tax rate and to abandon defenses that were otherwise available to them. I think that was a choice that they made knowingly, and they'll have to pay the consequences if that's what it turns out.
Of course, you will call the Dorrance executives were surcharged for that.
I didn't know that, Mr. Justice.
I just wonder here, if it were determined that Nevada, after all, where there's no inheritance tax, was the domicile. What about the estate paying California?
Well, I think
baseless inheritance taxes.
Well,
of course,
I think that that's
be entirely baseless, assuming that you can pierce the Summa Corporation veil, because you have some substantial taxes
some,
in California
it's not
because
the,
of your
it's
real
not
estate.
The bulk of the estate, but there are substantial assets in California.
Mr. Falk, are you a full-time attorney general for the state of California?
No, Mr. Justice, I am in private practice. I'm special counsel for the state of California in this
matter. Have you ever represented any other party to this case other than the state of California?
Absolutely not. And I have filed a sworn affidavit with this court, which was presented to Justice Powell and I think referred to the entire court, in which I set forth under penalty of perjury that this decision was made, and I will go farther and say that the papers were prepared and ready to be filed, or almost ready to be filed. They were at the printer before we had any discussion whatever with the estate on the subject of settlement. So the charge is just false.
Well, except this complaint doesn't ask the court to determine that the decedent, where the decedent was domiciled, whether Nevada or the Bahamas or Mexico or where, simply that he was, on the date of his death, not a domiciliary of Texas, period.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Now, as I say, we would be, if we thought it were necessary, if the court finds it necessary, we were prepared to amend it and to take our chances with the broader question. I see no purpose to be served by that. The estate has made its decision, and we have agreed to accept a lower rate of tax in settlement of that aspect of the case. And it seems to us that it serves the benefit of everyone to narrow the issue. We have really only one problem left. I thought that was a constructive thing to
do. It may well be.
That is, your statement is absolutely correct, Mr. Justice.
But we have to reach our decision on the basis of the pleadings as they are now before us.
Yes, I think that's
not
right.
On the basis of some possible amendment that you may have in mind.
I think that's a fair statement, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...